Take a network break. Our virtual donut vending machine now accepts Dogecoin, so help yourself to a treat while we analyze the latest tech news. We've got stories today on Juniper, HPE, Fortinet, and more. We're sponsored in part today by Palo Alto Networks. They're taking a fundamental leap forward with cloud-delivered security with Prisma Access 2.0. You can join Palo Alto for a launch event on March 17th to find out how Prisma Access 2.0 enhances security, supports your hybrid cloud strategy, and protects your remote workforce. Register at paloaltonetworks.com/prisma/access. That's paloaltonetworks.com/prisma/access. And stay tuned after the news. We've got a sponsored Tech Bytes convo where we're talking with Node 4. They're a managed security service provider. They're deploying and operating Fortinet's secure SD-WAN for customers, and Fortinet is the sponsor of that Tech Bytes. Last but not least, check out our human infrastructure newsletter. That's at packetpushers.net/newsletter. It's a free weekly newsletter. There are essays from the Packet Pushers, plus commentary on the best of the week's tech blogs, links to community blogs and videos, and other cool stuff.
Yeah, this week's newsletter actually on the topic of happiness, not necessarily a technology decision that you'll have to make, but it is a career decision, because sometimes your boss says, "Are you happy?" And I wrote up some ideas on
what do you say?
Wrote up some ideas on how you might want to handle that.
You wrote up, I think, some useful and a little bit cynical advice on how to handle that question, which is a tricky question. So, yeah,
my advice is to shut the heck up.
Pretty
plead the fifth and shut the heck up. Do I have to answer that, sir?
Absolutely. All right, let's do a little bit of FU follow-up. We've been reporting a few times on this. We talked about a Cisco mini switch that's supposed to provide power over Ethernet. There was a debate about whether that's really useful, particularly when you're talking about things like lighting. Do people really want that? And we got a lot of response about that.
It's been pretty interesting. I think one of the interesting things about cabling and switches is that it's a topic that anybody can participate in. And you often have, you know, the physical infrastructure is also such a big part of networking infrastructure. Anyway, James wrote to us and he said, PoE lighting never made a lick of sense to me with because of power efficiency. He's making the point that it seems foolish to run low voltage over thinner cable because at low voltage, you have to increase the current. And this is, of course, the bigger problem with power over Ethernet is that if you're going to try and draw 90 watts out of a switch and you've only got a 48 volt line because you can't run more than 48 volts DC, then you try and pull 2 amps down this tiny little cable. And then you get the problem with transmitting DC, of course, is loss. You have to, the only way to keep the current or not to lose power in the transmission is to drive it at higher and higher voltages, but you don't want to have higher and higher voltage because it's dangerous and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so he's sort of saying, like, you know, this is the problem here. How do you get the power down? Now, I think the safety angle here has been handled by the IEEE, largely to do with auto sensing. So if the current draw gets out of control in some way, shape, or form, then the switch, the PoE technology in the switch port itself is designed to automatically shut down. So if you try to draw too much current too quickly, if you try to overdraw, then the switch shuts down. It acts as a fuse box, if you will. So there is that, but he has got a very good point in that you can't run PoE for very long distances because the loss in the circuit, the shear transmission losses, are a problem. But that's perfectly fine for Cisco, of course, because then they say that you need more switches everywhere. And then, of course, people stop thinking about, oh, but that means that I have to have power sockets everywhere. So now all of a sudden you run power sockets everywhere to put the switches everywhere so that you can put the lights up. And yeah. So generally, I just tried to summarize the issue that, you know, sure, LEDs don't use a lot of power, but they still need a lot of current, especially when you've got a lot of them. But the switches can only be within a certain distance because of DC power propagation. Yeah. And obviously enough of other people thought that idea and have gone like, no, because we haven't seen too much in that industrial Ethernet phase just being used to power lights and door locks and things like that. So, yeah.
Right, all your smart lights and smart IoT devices, yeah.
And this conversation went on. Somebody else wrote in who wanted to be anonymous saying, I said no one's going to use power over Ethernet to charge laptops and cell phones. USB has won that battle. And, of course, he's pointing out that you can, of course, go onto Amazon and buy a PoE to USB-C charging station, which is kind of proving my point, I felt. But okay, thank you for that. I thought the point there was more that you're not going to see people implementing PoE inside of laptops. You know, your Apple laptop, for example, or your Dell laptop is not going to be powered off an Ethernet line and charge its battery off an Ethernet line for the same reasons. You are talking about 90-watt power supplies, and delivering 90 watts down 48 ports of Ethernet, it requires a phenomenal power supply at the other end, transmission losses and so forth. You will much more likely see USB-C. And keep in mind too that the Ethernet connector is so big that it doesn't make sense. It forms a mechanical problem in the design. It's actually a weak point in the modern aluminium chassis to have an Ethernet jack in there, and you can't design around it. It creates a failure point, just in case you hadn't thought about it from that point of view. But he's, as he points out, I'm not saying this is the most practical way to do it. He's just saying there may be use cases for PoE other than IoT. Although he goes on to say that the Cisco micro PoE duct switch is still useless in his point because of the power and problems like that. The duct switch one is not line powered. You need to actually have desk power to make that work. Must be some safety issue around grounding it on the duct or whatever. So if you're going to look at these switches, maybe look really carefully and think your way through all of the implementation to make sure that they actually work for you.
That's right. And as always, if you want to follow up on anything you hear today or on a past show, just hit us up, packetpusher.net/FU. And you can be anonymous if you like. We always love to get commentary, feedback, and corrections. All right, let's do some news where people can correct us. Juniper Networks, they're rebranding several products to bring them under an automation portfolio. It's initially targeting service providers and telcos. This new branding is called Paragon, and there are a bunch of pieces that it encompasses, so let's go through them. First is Paragon Pathfinder. This is path selection through network. It was formerly known as North Star, and Paragon Planner for network modeling, formerly known as the North Star Planner.
Yeah, so the North Star was originally started out as an SDN for MPLS tool in the sense that you could... it would calculate the MPLS paths and then help you provision the network underneath. It would certainly read it and then help you with the provisioning and the design. So where are the MPLS overlays in the network going? And then, of course, an MPLS networking technology has to be programmed into every switch. It doesn't just, you know, the BGP is only partially autonomous when it comes to MPLS. So you have to do a fair bit of the configuration work yourself. And North Star is the application in their portfolio they've been using to do that for some time. It's not so much that North Star was a bad name. It's just that it was disconnected from the rest of the portfolio. So this unifies with the NetRounds acquisition.
Yeah, that's the next piece of this. They're now NetRounds. It was a startup that Juniper bought in the fall of 2020. They do essentially active testing of services like voice and video. You can essentially run a synthetic transaction to find out how well this service is running. This is now known as Paragon Active Assurance.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't qualify NetRounds as a startup. They've been around for more than a decade, and they've been pretty well established. They had a pretty substantial piece of revenue, and they have a lot of customers. And the thing about NetRounds is, as you said, the active assurance. That is, they have probes around the network, and they do simulated transactions. And you have this orchestration platform that you can click onto it, and you can say, run these tests. So you can run voice call simulations, HTTP simulations, logins. And of course, once you've got those probes all at various nodes in your network, you can either be testing the connectivity to the cloud, you can be testing voice calls inside of the SD-WAN network that you've just deployed or whatever. I'm a big fan of this active assurance type idea over the years, because I found it very useful to be able to, the classic one that I've talked about a fair bit, in a situation that I was in where we had a lot of problems with the network during the week, but we didn't know if the network was broken out of hours because there was nobody in the offices. And so we were able to set up the remote probes to run tests all weekend. And in some cases, we were actually able to run high volumes of tests, like to actually saturate the links to see if it had any impact. What we were able to prove is that the same problems happened on the weekend as it was during the week. It wasn't related to load or overload or to faulty cost strategies. And so that gave us that extra angle on the data to do things. Now, of course, the technology has gone much more into the monitoring, the cost, the analytics, the telemetry far. So bundling that up with MPLS makes sense, because if you're selling MPLS paths, what you're trying to do here is closed loop automation. And that is, I provision the path, now I test the path. And you need both parts of that portfolio.
Absolutely. Or if you want to get out of a potential troubleshooting situation, you've got SLAs to meet, you can use this to make sure you're meeting your commitments if you're a service provider.
Well, service providers don't actually want to test if the SLAs. Because if they're broken, they have to spend money to fix it, right? So they don't actually want to... sorry, did I say that out loud?
You did, yeah.
In theory, they want to be able to validate that their service levels are working. And perhaps they could offer this to a customer as a value add to say, hey, we are meeting our commitments to you.
Yep.
I don't know. Doesn't seem like something that telcos have ever done before, so they're not likely to start. But maybe. But I would, as a network owner, I think from my point of view, these active assurance nodes also mean you can have an SD-WAN and an MPLS and a 5G and a, you know, remote VPN nodes and all sorts, and you can bring all of that into a unified reporting platform instead of saying, like, here's my SD-WAN tool, it's working okay, and then using your SNMP monitoring tool to look at the legacy WAN, you know, and trying to stitch it together. And, right. And that's the reality that a lot of us are in today, is we don't have one network anymore. We have many, and overlay networks, yep. and underlays, and some of them are private circuits, you know, it's private bandwidth circuits. Some of them public bandwidth. Some of them are using IPsec VPNs. Some of them are using, you know, whatever. So yeah, not easy. And, you know, how do you bring together your testing? So this is where this comes from. And the third part of the announcement is the Contrail HealthBot part.
Yeah, HealthBot, they had announced that, I think it might have been last year. It's essentially a cloud-based analytics tool that can monitor network and device health. And now this is called Paragon Insights.
Yeah, so HealthBot focuses on device, and particularly it's related to taking streaming telemetry from the device itself. And the idea behind HealthBot, I think, originally started as a bunch of scripts from an internal project. It got out of hand and turned into a product because customers went, we really want that. So now you've got the situation where you can monitor the user experience. You've got North Star so that you can actually do the automation and the configuration tooling. And then you've got HealthBot, mm-hmm. which is telling you the device health and whether the device is, you know, is this line card overloaded? Is this CPU broken? Is this SFP playing up? That type of stuff. So really that closed loop, you know, the whole cycle, if you jump into the whole portfolio, Juniper's calling that Paragon, so that the whole network ownership and operation cycle comes together.
Yeah, there's one more element of this. Juniper has a partnership with Anuta Atom. I think we talked about it. Atom is a closed-loop orchestration product. Atom's not getting the Paragon branding, but Juniper is including it sort of as part of the overall platform. Mm-hmm. If you want to integrate closed-loop orchestration and automation, then Anuta Atom is part of this Paragon positioning.
Which is really interesting because, and the interesting thing about this idea that they're bundling up their services. We've sort of had this situation where most of the companies have sort of gone, here's my MPLS, here's my SD-WAN, here's my, and they're all isolated little silos. And watching mm-hmm. this all come together and acknowledge that third parties but need to be tightly integrated with the core, this feels like a new Juniper to me. This feels like the old Juniper, which says, oh, we sell routers and do MPLS. And now it's very much more of a broad spectrum software approach. So I welcome the whole approach, really.
Yeah, I think it's smart of Juniper to essentially synthesize this automation and analysis portfolio, bring all these products under a naming convention, an umbrella to help tell a cleaner story to customers and sort of create that value proposition. They're also making it clear that you can use each of these individually. It's a very modular approach. You don't have to, if you buy one, you don't have to buy them all, but they're also telling a works better together kind
of
story.
Yeah, a land and expand strategy, you know, sell customer one of these things, you know. So, you know, for example, if you're looking at device health and you're concerned about, are my core routers handling the load, I can get Paragon Insights. But then, of course, once you've got the insights, the next thing you need to know is the end-to-end service working, and then you start to expand your presence inside of the customer. That's not historically something that Juniper has done. Historically, they sold this, and this is what we do, and we do this better than anybody else. And and then we're done, right? And that's not the way the world is moving into the future. It's much more of an integrated portfolio selling methodology.
We have a link to an official Juniper blog in the show notes that accompany this podcast if you want to go read it for yourself. Let's move on. Fortinet has announced new Zero Trust Network Access and Secure Access Services Edge, or SASE, capabilities. These new capabilities are part of the rollout of the 7.0 version of Fortinet's operating system that runs everything they do.
Buzzword bingo, just in those last five sentences, Drew. Zero Trust, Secure Access,
winner chicken dinner.
Yeah, yeah. I think the key thing here is that Fortinet has been getting into the SD-WAN with its take on that, based around more on the path management, you know, this IPsec tunnel type thing and load balancing across the tunnels, and leaning heavily into the custom hardware capability. And obviously, mm-hmm. as a security company, people are looking at them and saying, well, over here is Palo Alto, and they've got CloudGenix, and they've got the security, and that whole strategy that does the dynamic security controls at the edge. And this feels like a competitive response to that. You know, all the other security players are moving into the same space, Cisco and, you know, so forth.
I mean, with Gartner coming out and defining the SASE, Secure Access Services Edge category, which is a terrible name, by the way, everybody who sells you a networking or security product now has to have SASE. And so I think Fortinet is following along here. They are trying to build out a suite to match sort of what you'd expect from a SASE capability. So they do have a set of POPs where you can direct traffic to, and the POPs will do things like next-gen firewall, IPS, and so on. But it feels to me like they've still got some work to do building out their geographical presence. They say they've got a global presence, but they couldn't say how many POPs they have at the outset. So it's going to take some time to build that out, I think, to be a very complete and full SASE offering.
Yeah, Fortinet tends to do things itself. So where other companies go out and buy somebody and then attempt to sort of hammer the square peg into the round hole of their product portfolio and, you know, carve a bit off here and then spend some money building out, you know, this, you know, whatever. Fortinet tends to do it all internally. So does that mean it might come to the market a little later? Yeah, maybe. They also do it from a slightly different perspective. They also have their own sort of ways. They do lean into hardware a lot. But I imagine that they are literally built this from the ground up, and it's taking them a little while to get to market. And they also don't, I don't have the sense that Fortinet leads the market for a lot of things. Like, you know, there are companies there that are always getting there first or doing it first. And my sense of Fortinet is that's not the way they operate. They would like to see something to be established before they start committing a substantial amount of resources and rolling out a product. They don't want to take a risk with their business, but also with their customers.
Right. I think the other part of their strategy is they're adopting a one of everything approach. They have an entire security portfolio that covers everything you could think about security, from endpoint to detection and response to analytics and automation and AI and ML and all that, VPNs, secure remote access, now zero trust network access. So their goal is to have one of everything, to build a platform essentially that you buy into, and it's all Fortinet. If you've got third party things, they also have a fabric to tie into that, but it's basically use our platform.
Yeah.
Simplify your life and come to the Fortinet house.
For sure. Yeah. Well, and that's not to say that Fortinet does not acquire companies. Like, even just in 2020, they acquired two companies, Panopta and Opaque, or Opaque, if you like.
Yeah. Opaque, yes.
That's not a lot of acquisitions. Like, they don't have a history of acquiring companies pretty all the time. Like, Cisco will acquire 10 to 30 companies in any given year, whereas Fortinet's much more like maybe one every 2 or 3 years, except for last year. But the ones that they bought were particularly into threat management, where building up a team to do that would take too long, and they were able to come to get the market. So that's just in case I sort of gave the impression that Fortinet would never buy another company. I was saying generally they would not. They would build it internally.
And part of that is because everything they do essentially springs from their FortiOS, which is why they led with the 7.0 version as part of this announcement, that all the new capabilities come because they are doing a software upgrade that essentially rolls across their entire portfolio.
I do feel like Fortinet should pick up the pace. Like, the market is moving quickly. Like, if you look at the other SD-WAN vendors and the SASE technologies going on, it is a very accelerated position.
I guess I feel like the marketing is moving quickly. I don't know, which may be different from actually what customers are buying and using.
Viable answer.
You know, Fortinet is here to tick those boxes.
Viable answer. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, you know, you're not wrong. It's like, what is it? There was a statistic that went around recently, like SD-WAN has been adopted by 5% or 10% of enterprises to date.
Right.
I mean, yeah,
right.
They're still...
Which boggles our minds, because we're like, we've been talking about SD-WAN forever. Doesn't everybody have one now?
8 years now. Yeah. So maybe 2021 is the year of SD-WAN. Woo! <I don't know.
laughs> Anyway, links in the show notes if you want to find out more. We've got more news to give you. First, insurance for cyber attacks such as ransomware on the rise. This is according to a website sharing details from a Moody report. One key issue is that the same cyber attack could hit multiple clients simultaneously, which means a big payout by insurers, and insurers don't like to pay out, so they are reassessing their approach to the cybersecurity insurance market.
Yeah, now this has always been interesting. I've been watching the cyber idea that cyber insurance matters. And if you understand the insurance industry, I had the fortune to work inside of an insurance company for a period of time at a very senior level. And one of the things that they talk about a lot is a thing called moral hazard. Now, moral hazard is a principle in insurance that sheerly giving people an insurance option causes more accidents. So if you, the quote from Wikipedia is, moral hazard occurs when one person takes more risks because someone else bears the burden of those risks. So one of the interesting facts of car insurance is, because your car is insured, people drive badly because the car is insured, right? They don't bear the loss of the car if the car gets totaled. And so the cost of insurance is actually made more expensive than it needs to be because their insurance exists. And this is what's happening in cyber insurance, is that companies take out cyber insurance and then stop bothering to spend money on cybersecurity, right? There's no downsides to having bad security because your company doesn't fail or go out of business. Your reputation doesn't get damaged. Look at SolarWinds, right? How's that going? So up until now, the other side of this is that cyber insurance has been reasonably cheap. And then so security gets, you know, not a whole lot of investment. So if the price of cyber insurance rises, then logically the cost of security will also rise because more and more companies will opt out of paying for cyber insurance, and or much more likely to my mind is it'll be like what car insurance funds have done with cars is say, well, we won't insure these cars, or we will increase the premiums on car insurance until the cars are made safer. And that's what will happen in cyber insurance. Is already we have the situation where the cyber insurance people will send out agents to inspect your network and validate it, audit your secure, your cybersecurity, and issue you a policy cost based on your security. And if you don't spend on security, your insurance premium may rise to the level where it makes sense to do more security. So this is a good thing for the industry. Increasing premiums means increased security. Isn't it weird?
Yeah, I don't know that it means increased security, because we know that by evidence that a lot of folks just don't take security seriously because they know they can just offer some credit monitoring and an apology and then move on with their lives. I feel like cyber insurance could be useful for local municipalities, small hospitals, SMBs, the kind of organizations that can't afford a lot of tools and experts and really shouldn't have to. And so cyber insurance kind of gives them a backstop to that they won't just be cratered by like a ransomware attack. But I also think the cyber insurance companies have realized, holy cow, it's really easy to launch a ransomware attack against our clients and we are paying a lot money.
And a lot of these companies aren't doing anything to protect themselves. They don't have good backups and so forth. And a lot of companies don't bother with a backup because they say the cyber insurance will cover it, right?
Yeah, and I get your point about moral hazard, but I also think the other side of this moral hazard coin is, and this is something you've banged on about a lot, Greg, is that right now all the security risk is on the person who purchases the product as opposed to the person who made the product, and that's really not fair.
And also product quality. This comes back to this idea because I bang on a lot about the idea of product quality. You know, does a security product
software quality.
And a lot of the problems with cybersecurity actually extend from poor quality products, rush to market, you know, minimum viable product, product feature velocity, you know, all that sort of stuff, or simple maximizing profit type stuff. And there's no penalty for vendors who provide a low quality product, literally, right?
Right.
Whereas cyber insurance premiums say, oh, I see you're using this product. And we know that that product has had a long history of insecurity. So we're going to charge your cyber insurance more. And then customers stop buying that product over time. Does that make sense?
It would be really interesting to see something like that emerge where a cyber security sort of insurer audit starts to influence buying decisions.
But it will, because it's the same with cars. Because when people buy cars, they know that if you buy a Rolls Royce, you know, the insurance policy for that is this much. But if you go and buy, you know, standard middle of the road, family wagon, the insurance policy is much cheaper because the parts for that car are cheaper. And it's also true that that car has been made safe. So, you know.
Yeah, there's a lot to chew on here. Definitely a lot to chew on.
It's a long-term trend. It's not going to happen. This is not going to happen in 6 months.
Right. I'm really curious to see how the insurance industry starts to tackle their risk and what that means for software developers and people who sell products to customers. It's going to be interesting.
Yep. Especially if the insurance companies get involved, because when they turn up at a vendor's shop and say, we'd like to recommend your products at our customer site, what are you going to do to prove because they're not buying the product.
Yes.
They're going to be saying like, we see, you know, the loss adjuster is going to say like, we see that over the last 20 years, you've reported over 2,500 vulnerabilities. Your product really doesn't meet our minimum requirements. Have you, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
That could be.
Yes, that will be interesting. Yeah. All right, a few more to go, but just a brief announcement from our sponsor, Palo Alto Networks. Palo Alto Networks Prisma Access secures your remote and distributed workforce from the cloud by integrating firewall as a service, cloud secure web gateway, zero trust network access, and even more capabilities into a single cloud-delivered solution. Prisma Access protects employees and apps no matter where they are. And now Palo Alto Networks is taking a fundamental leap forward with the debut of Prisma Access 2.0. Join us for a launch event on March 17th to find out how Prisma Access 2.0 enhances security, supports your hybrid cloud strategy, and protects your remote workforce. It's on March 17th. Join us for all the details, plus hear from industry leaders and customers on the latest trends in security, automation, and cloud security. Go to paloaltonetworks.com/prisma/access to register. That's paloaltonetworks.com/prisma/access to register for the March 17th live event. Hope to see you there. All right, back to the news. A new subsea fiber optic cable capable of 250 terabits per second is ready for service, according to Google.
250 terabits per second. That kind of boggles my mind. I remember in the 2000s, you know, the peak of the dot-com boom, and they were laying fiber transatlantic and talking about 20 gigabits per second.
Wow.
Something like that. And those fibers have all reached the end of their useful life. Not the actual mechanical properties of that fiber is now degrading in a lot of circumstance, and the signal repeaters and boosters and so forth are all reaching the end of their operational life. And so it's important that we get new cables out there. And one of the things that hasn't been happening is the traditional telcos have not been building out new cables. And if they do, they take a decade to get it done. You know, they sort of think about it and argue about it and get it done. Here's what Google did, is announced this very early in 2018. And in early 2021, pretty much 3 years from start to finish, although they did say they were going to finish it in, I think, November 2020, but they didn't make that goal. They've deployed a cable from Virginia to the south of France at 250 terabits per second using a modern, unproven technology, might I add. No qualms about diving into the deep end, as you might expect from the Goog. It really sort of showing how it can done. That's what stand out to me. The point that I wanted to make is, here is Google, admittedly a behemoth with virtually unlimited funds, doing work that telcos should be doing it substantially faster, substantially better, using modern technology and approaches, and getting the job done.
A hat tip to Google for pulling it off. It is impressive. Yeah.
And I mean, like, it's also odd here. The things that stand out is, if you actually go and look at the telegeography submarine cable map, you'll notice most cables go from the same point in America to the same point in the UK. They all follow the same path. And in this one, Google's following some of the same path across the central in the North Atlantic Ocean, but landing the cable directly in the south of France. And it's also coming much further south in the USA, on down in Virginia, I think, sort of suggests that Google's actually built its own landing stations. Like, the landing stations are often shared.
Yes. Mm. Yep. That could be. Yeah. That's the additional investment, aside from just the subsea cable, is having some place to attach it to on either end.
Yeah. Where they landed in southern France has got me a little concerned, because that's a big shipping lane. And, you know, one good anchor could fix up a lot of, you know, there's a reason that they often land in the UK, and that's to avoid the shipping that runs up and down the European coastline. Like, a lot of freight actually gets moved by vessels down from the West African coast right the way up through the West European coast and that type of stuff. And so these cables are vulnerable to breakage. That's why they normally land in the UK and then hop over to Amsterdam from there. So it's interesting to see this one going to the south of France and not to the main pops like Amsterdam.
Well, it's pretty interesting. And again, link in the show notes if you want to go look at it for yourself. Moving on, HPE is touting new research into optical lasers for high-performance compute, specifically a memristor laser.
So again, this is from the weird part of our portfolio. I like to keep an eye on unusual things. Now, if you remember from 2016, HPE did a big song and dance about the memristor. You were there. Do you remember?
I do not.
It was called The Machine, the HP Machine. And all of their conferences were led with the HP Machine. And there was these glossy keynote presentations for 15 to 30 minutes of premium keynote on The Machine and how HPE would soon have the memristor. And then it suddenly faded away. And it turns out that making the memristor was much harder than they thought. And what struck me about this is that they just basically posted a very short blog post which said, it's still coming. We're still making progress on this. So HPE is still developing the silicon technology and building the chips that would enable a memristor to work. Why does this matter? A memristor is a variable resistor device. a transistor is actually a variable current device. That's a gross oversimplification, but let's go with that for the purposes of this podcast. And what it would do is that because of the way that it works, it would allow us to enable memory-driven computing architectures. Most of us know about the von Neumann architecture with the CPU, and the CPU reads the memory and processes an instruction and hands it back. The memristor allows us to just put everything into memory and do stuff in memory. So you've talked about SAP, HANA doing in-memory databases and that sort of stuff. This is very much that model. Everything's just done in memory, and there can be multiple processing engines working on the same piece of memory. And it also turns out that this memristor architecture is perfect for synaptic, neural synaptic mathematics. So when you get into artificial intelligence, you can use memristor devices in theory, and in proof of concepts in labs to make much more efficient chipsets for processing neural net mathematics at a fraction of the power. So where a GPU draws 100 watts or more, you know, we've got GPU cards doing games at way more than 100 watts, a memristor is down in the sub 10 watt range. So you can do a lot more computing for a lot less power. You get a chipset design that's almost custom made for AI and ML, and leads into things like neuromorphic computing and stuff like that. I'm going to leave it at that, except to say, very exciting to see that HPE is still working on that technology. And if you want to go down a rat hole, it sort of highlights how different HPE is from who was back then. So in that era, there was a different CEO, and it really felt like, and that CEO was an egotist and wanted to run around congratulating themselves on how clever they were for being at HPE. Whereas since Antonio Neri's come along, we've seen HPE spin around and just focus on core competencies like hyperconverged infrastructure, storage, networking, you know, the basics, and just get on with it. Yep. So I know that's a long stretch from the memristor, but that's what I was thinking when I read this article.
I mean, it's nice to see big companies like HPE still having some investment in far-flung research projects that could yield significant benefits if they pay off.
Yeah, and this is something that could really have a transformational change. And they did have it working back in 2016. They did actually have a functional machine, literally big M machine, but obviously they weren't able to commercialize it somehow. So
you found a YouTube video about the machine from HPE, which we'll have in the show notes if you want to go see what all the hype was about.
It was a lot. And I remember sitting in the audience going, whoa, wow, you know. A bit like composable architecture. That was another one I didn't quite so think. But anyway.
That's right. All right, two shows to go before we wrap. First, back to Fortinet. They reported their Q4 and full year financial results. For the fourth quarter, the company had revenues of $748 million, up 21% year over year. And for the full year, Fortinet took in $2.59 billion in revenue, up 20%, and had net income of $488 million, also up year over year. So a tidy Q4 and full year for Fortinet on the financial numbers.
Yeah, and what's probably the main thing here is that Fortinet has had a substantial increase in share price from somewhere around about the $110, $120 range, now climbing up towards $160. So they're growing and growing strongly. What's interesting here is to compare them with Cisco. So Cisco reported numbers that were basically in line with what they predicted, and their share price fell 5% because they're not actually showing a path to growth. They're saying, oh, we're transitioning to subscriptions and blah, blah, blah. But so is Fortinet. But Fortinet is actually growing the revenue line business, growing sales, and all Cisco can do is get smaller and turn the revenue down. So there's a contrast there. Cisco's doing fine. You know, it's building up subscription revenue, and customers love Cisco because it generates so much profits and it can pay dividends. But Fortinet is actually, as a business, is growing substantially. Now, admittedly, it's much smaller. Revenues of $748 million less than one-tenth the size of Cisco, but they're growing. And yet you go and look at some of the other technology vendors at the bigger end of the market, and they're shrinking by a substantial amount, 1% to 5% per quarter. So interesting to contrast the two and see who's succeeding and who's not.
Yeah, well, you know, Cisco seems to be moving into a steady state mode, preserving revenue and keeping customers and not growing, but still thriving. Fortinet, very well poised for growth. And we need the security market overall is very hot and going to continue to be, as folks are still grappling with work from home and how remote work and distributed work are going to sort of be the future. So yeah, sunny days ahead for security.
Yeah,
companies.
I think so. We've seen the same with Palo Alto. Checkpoint had a tough quarter. They came out with numbers. People aren't real hot on Checkpoint these days. I'm not really sure who's buying Checkpoint these days, if you've probably already got it, I guess. But, you know, Checkpoint's a bit of a mixed bag. So it's interesting to see how this plays out if you follow the numbers.
Yep. All right, and then back to HPE to wrap up. The company has announced Spaceborne Computer 2. This is a new computer that will be delivered to the International Space Station to process experimental and medical data on board the space station instead of having to beam it all back to Earth.
Yeah, so this is a bit of a marketing coup for HPE, I think. This is much more of a reflection of their government, their work with the U.S. government, obviously a long-established supplier to the U.S. government. And this really reads like, you know, everybody's going to space. I wonder if we could put a computer in space. Wow, that's a great story. Let's go and do that, right?
Yes.
So that's what I sort of thought about this story, is that it is something where HPE can go back to customers and say, we're really getting this right. You should totally be working with us because we are really good at this. And it's just fun to see everybody getting onto the space bandwagon. You've just got this feeling that I reckon sometime next year we'll see a space router from Cisco or something.
Part of the effort, according to HPE, is that they're trying to see if they can get essentially use off-the-shelf components that could survive, you know, all the vibrations of a launch and also the high doses of radiation that these components are going to get while they're in orbit. So the whole point is to try to commoditize space computing, because obviously there are computers running on satellites and in the space station now. HPE is using the ProLiant server in this, so essentially an off-the-shelf server, but making it space worthy. So I think that's sort of the cool point here, that they can maybe commoditize this a little bit more instead of having to do highly specialized and hardened components.
Yeah. And it's also interesting that it's done in partnership with Azure. Did you see that? That it's actually going to be a node.
Oh, I didn't
see that.
It's
going to be a node in the Azure cloud. I think that's a reflection of the fact that Azure is relies on HPE to supply a lot of its components for its cloud. So they make servers in volume. I don't know for certainty one way or another of that. But the HPE announcement plays down the Microsoft part, but other announcers play up the, here we go, through a collaboration with Microsoft Azure Space, researchers are running experiments on Spaceborne Computer 2, have the opportunity to burst the Azure cloud for computationally intense processing needs, and can also transmit the results back to Spaceborne Computer 2. So, okay. So there's a collaboration there with Azure, which is interesting.
Space cloud.
So there's a new subdivision in our space networking feature called Space Cloud. And on that comedy note,
that wraps up the show. Thanks for listening. Please stay tuned for our Tech Bytes conversation. It's sponsored by Fortinet. We're talking with Node4. That's a managed security service provider who's rolling out Fortinet's secure SD-WAN for customers. That's coming right up.
You're listening to the Tech Bytes podcast from the Packet Pushers. Today, we're talking with Node4, a managed security service provider, about deploying and operating Fortinet's secure SD-WAN for its customers. And as you may have guessed, Fortinet is our sponsor. Our guest from Node4 is Glenn Acesta. He is the lead network services architect. Glenn, welcome to the podcast. And can you start us off by telling us why Node4 partnered with Fortinet for SD-WAN?
Hi there. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, definitely. So we had a partnership with Fortinet already, previous to SD-WAN. That initially started with the next generation firewall, the FortiGate. Mm-hmm. We built a multi-tenanted platform off the back of that. So it was a multi-tenant FortiGate with many individual virtual instances on there. And we evaluated the market for SD-WAN and just found that the feature set and the cost performance of the SD-WAN from Fortinet just seemed strides ahead. And the security integration as well was a really critical point for us.
Okay, so already partnering with Fortinet, so you thought, let's evaluate their SD-WAN. It looks like a fit, and that security integration makes sense for your customers, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Okay, so what then, for you as a managed security service provider, what kind of value are you getting from Fortinet?
For us, it was definitely the combination of the security capabilities. Their SD-WAN was kind of integrated security in the core, and that was a bit of a massive differentiator from the other solutions that we looked at. We already understood their products, which was great for us operationally and technically. The integrations with other solutions as well meant that we could integrate it with our portfolio and our other services. And the network capabilities built in with the advanced routing stack meant that we could use BGP and everything that we would have done before with more legacy routers in a single appliance. So that was great.
That's important for you because you're a service provider. You don't get paid on the number of boxes you ship. You're not like a a reseller who ships boxes and selling a firewall and a router and, you know, all these other tools is actually good for business. Greater profit, single deal, you know, more revenue, kill the customer and all that sort of stuff. What you're actually selling here is a service deal. And if you can do more with less, then you make more profit.
Yeah, absolutely. We're trying to consolidate and we're trying to sell in, you know, in the nicest way possible, as many service towers as we can to that customer to deliver them a real end-to-end solution that delivers them value rather than just putting in point solutions and trying to meet particular checkboxes.
And I presume also from an operational perspective, having fewer consoles that you're trying to switch from to do things for your customers probably also makes a difference.
Yeah, definitely. The operational aspects and the technical upskilling required if you have many different vendors would have been quite prohibitive for us. So yeah, absolutely, the cost savings and the operational savings.
It's important from the perspective of resellers offering professional services as part of their portfolio or a managed service to not have too many vendors so that you can build up a focus in the operational side, that is managing the day-to-day, a focus for deployment, but also a focus for sales so that the sales team doesn't have to keep finding all the new products and everything like that. So focusing down on one vendor partner with a box or a service that's wrapped up inside a single thing is actually generally good for business, for resellers and professional services organizations.
Yeah, we build up the expertise. We also work shoulder to shoulder with Fortinet. We've got a great relationship with the team there as a result of our, you know, single approach to partner with them to deliver these services.
I also wanted to touch very briefly on something you mentioned earlier, that there's a full BGP routing stack within the appliance that you're using that's also doing firewalling and SD-WAN. So you've got additional capabilities on hand if a customer or you have some special requirement that's going to require a little bit of extra routing.
Yeah, we have, you know, one of the great features of the Fortinet SD-WAN is that you can change the route map applied to BGP based on some of the SD-WAN health checks. So we utilize that fully so that we can influence the routing back into the site as well as on the way out, because the SD-WAN does a great job of load balancing on the available connectivity. Mm-hmm. But if we advertise the routes we want to receive back in on that connection using the route maps, then that's great for us. It makes it symmetric.
Mm. Did you find that a problem? Like a lot of people would go, oh, I have to have my, you know, Coca-Cola BGP, you know, my brand name of BGP. And from my preferred router vendor, did you find that an apocalyptic experience? Or was it just like, eh?
It was just a case of testing it and make sure that all the features that, you know, we expected to be in there worked in the way that they always have before. And we found that that was absolutely the case.
Now, one other part about the Fortinet thing is this centralized management console that you get for the SD-WAN and also for the security function. So you end up with this cloud managed. Is that something that's relevant to you delivering services to your clients?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it comes back to the multiple services. We have enhanced the SD-WAN with the SD branch extending into LAN and Wi-Fi and network access control. And being able to manage that through one console makes things operationally great for us and also means that we can give our customers access so that they can, in some cases, bypass us to make changes directly, which is great for them and great for us.
Mm. It must be a change, because before you would have had Wi-Fi from this vendor in the branch, and then you would have had campus switches, and then you have the router, and then somewhere you would have looped the traffic back. So bundling all this up is a bit of a transition, less vendors.
It is, yeah. We don't have to worry about the interoperability and compatibility of different vendors and different products. So yeah,
I'm just thinking of it more from a troubleshooting, from a couple of points. There's a troubleshooting one. You know, if you're trying to troubleshoot a connection from the Wi-Fi, you don't have to go to three different management platforms or CLI into three different boxes to get out a map of what's happening in the branch.
Exactly that. And also the demarcation. You know, I'm sure you've been in a service provider environment before.
Yeah.
When there's multiple providers involved, everyone's pointing fingers at each other.
Yeah, And there's the wireless guy, there's the campus guy, there's the router guy, and they're all going, well, I can't see you're wrong. Yeah.
Everyone's blaming each other.
Well, they're not blaming each other, but, you know, nobody wants to go through the process of digging into the network only to discover it's DNS, right?
So everyone just points the finger at us because we deliver the lot and then we can't escape it. But that's better for everyone involved in
it. It's kind
of
better
of
that way, because you've got a unified tool, you'll probably know anyway. So,
yeah.
So you mentioned you want to sell, obviously, towers of service to customers. So did you bring SD-WAN to them, or were they asking you for SD-WAN?
It was primarily customer-led. In a lot of scenarios, we're customer-led. But, you know, we had engaged with vendors and we were evaluating the market because this is something we saw as taking off. But when the customers started asking us for it, that really cemented that decision and made us move to action a lot quicker.
And what were they asking you for? Like, what are they hoping to get out of SD-WAN?
Everyone's talking about moving to the cloud. I think there was a big shift to and a big hype around moving to public cloud, and that's maybe settled more around the hybrid model now. You know, that is supported by SD-WAN in a lot of ways. And as a part of that, introducing more internet access, you know, that leads on to having multiple connections at sites, sometimes of different types. And the SD-WAN, again, just complements that and the visibility and control from doing that as well.
So getting to cloud there, are they like looking to access software as a service, or was it more, we want to build an application in say a GCP or an Azure or whatever, and we need to get our end users there?
It was a mix of the two, to be honest. There was some building apps in the cloud, which we sometimes help with, and then software as a service adoption as well, and being able to route those different applications over the right circuits at the right in the right way.
And was the cloud access issue that they didn't want to be lumping users back to some, you know, headquarters and then back out again? They wanted more direct access? Or what is it about cloud access that SD-WAN's solving for them?
Yeah, exactly that. People want the efficiency of going directly out to the internet rather than bringing it back through a data center, through a pinch point to get out to the internet.
Why pay? I mean, it's just like, why pay for all that? Why pay to send traffic to head office when you can just not bother? It just seems like we only used to do it because that was the only thing we could do. You know, we always built hub and spoke architectures, you know, star architectures, because that was all we could do. Most of our routing protocols were so stupid that anything more complicated than a star architecture pretty much was impossible.
Yeah, and people like to do things in the way they've always done them, don't they? So it was a bit of a shift.
Yeah, I just like to highlight to people that, you know, the only reason we used to do it that way was because that was the only way we could do it. That's what worked. And now everything's changed. A lot of those things that we used to do, a lot of that logic is gone.
I believe you've got a customer story that you can share with us, somebody who's actually using this.
Yeah, so we've got a great customer. It was our first customer that we delivered a solution to. I think I'm okay to name them. It's Stagecoach. So a large UK bus operator. Yeah, we delivered an SD-WAN for them. We, you know, they were looking to move to a cloud-first approach, so they ticked a lot of the boxes that, or had a lot of the challenges that SD-WAN solves. And we were up against some pure-play vendors as well, so we really had to sell the benefits of this solution and our expertise and Fortinet's technology to get us there.
How many sites are we talking?
It was 250 sites in total, or thereabouts.
Okay, so significant.
Was there any particular product that you're running there, like for Stagecoach to choose you over, you know, any of the other competitors in this space? There would have been one thing that probably stuck out in the deal.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I was going to call them out, I think it'd be two. So the security capabilities of Fortinet is strides ahead of everyone else. They were looking at an SD-WAN product and a security product delivered in the cloud, which means they've then got to buy two expensive products, which leads on to the second point, which is the cost to performance is just outstanding compared to the alternatives we've seen.
Yeah, this is where Fortinet's custom hardware actually is extremely valuable, because they actually have custom ASICs inside of the hardware devices at the edge that do make security and routing and packet forwarding and all those things actually high speed.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly what we found. Mm.
And do you have a sense of sort of the before and after picture for them, like what benefits they got out of this SD-WAN adoption?
Yeah, they're really happy with the solution. We, you know, have had comments all the way from the delivery where they were complimenting the zero touch and how easy and seamless that was for them deploying the equipment. But they're also seeing, you know, sort of 10 times performance over their previous network, cost savings through consolidation, and allowing them to introduce new applications and collaboration tools, which is even more important in the current kind of COVID climate.
So you had them installing hardware on site?
Yeah, we were supporting the installation of the hardware remotely. So the customer was actually taking the boxes to site and plugging them in, and we were doing the zero touch provisioning from remote.
Okay, so it was easy enough that you could just be on the phone with someone while they're plugging in a box and pushing some buttons and so on.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
That's kind of cool, really, because that meant you probably didn't have to run around the countryside for months and months just to install a box in a place, right?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I keep saying the same things, but it comes back to it's better for us and it's better for them. We're saving time and they're getting, you know, their service delivered quicker. So better all around for everyone.
Yeah, but it's just a transition. Like in the old days of routers, you would have had to handcraft a CLI config and bring the routers into head office and then put them in the back of the car and take them out to site, and then hopefully the MPLS circuit was actually up. This is is the internet circuit working before you go out? You know, just go out, plug this in, boom, up you're away sort of thing.
Yeah, no typing of config CLIs and things like that. We've had plenty of those nightmares in the past.
Yeah, and you haven't got the wrong IP, the service provider didn't give you the wrong IP address. It's just such a gap between the old and the new. And I believe you've also done SD-WAN on your own internal network for Node 4, the company.
We have, yeah. So we wanted to kind of live and breathe what we're selling to our customers, and that shows the confidence that we've got in the solution that we're delivering, both in terms of our expertise and the technology from Fortinet. So we're delivering the SD-WAN internally, along with the LAN Wi-Fi SD branch solution, network access control, and the remote VPN security fabric client.
But what kind of changes have you seen internally? Like, how are you measuring your own ROI?
So we're seeing cost savings again through consolidation. So we're consolidating different services that might have had, specific connectivity and solutions in place before. Things like proxies can go away because we do that on the boxes now in a distributed way, which is great for performance. And automation as well. We're really taking advantage of the API integrations to make things quicker and more efficient.
Mm. Can you drill down into that a little bit more? How are you using the APIs?
Well, there's a lot of tools we use internally that we've developed, and some of those are as simple and rudimentary as scraping license files received from Fortinet to get all of the SKUs and registration codes, and then using a tool to automatically register those with Fortinet. But for the actual service delivery and maintenance part, we have developed software portals internally that will take information from our customer, CMDB, and inventories, and derive the site configuration data from that to then build the zero-touch provisioning models and templates. Hmm.
So you can essentially go into a site having a sense of essentially what the architecture is and what you need to do there ahead of time.
Yeah, we've provisioned the hardware before it's even turned up on site. It's just a case of pushing that configuration to the device.
Okay, and this is because you can extract the data via the APIs.
Mm. Yeah, exactly that. All done through the APIs.
It's pretty cool, like how much of a gap that is from where we were just 5 years ago. How quickly that whole WAN thing has changed over the time. And as a service provider, it must be dramatically different internally.
Yeah, it is. It's a big shift. I mean, it's great because it frees up people's times when, you know, previously they were, like you say, putting variables in configs and applying them to legacy routers and that code kind updates. Of thing. It's just
code.
They're now updating software. Yeah.
You've got a router and you had to update the operating system, and you'd be there for 250 sites. That's 4 weeks' work just updating the iOS.
Yeah, but the shift is now that we've got development teams, we've got software teams as well that, you know, are doing work like coding and infrastructure as code instead of that sort of task.
That's interesting because the headcount didn't reduce per se, but they're actually doing more useful work, which is a common story. But
yeah, I think it's all about getting more output instead of just repeating the same rudimentary tasks over and over again.
So, Glenn, you mentioned API integration. What about, did it have any impact on your SOC? Because I imagine you must have a significant infrastructure for running customer services.
Yeah, so these boxes provide a lot of security services, and as a result, there's a lot of information that comes out of them that you need to analyze. So that all gets fed into a SOC where, you know, they evaluate the threats that are detected and take action based on those. And a lot of that is using, you know, other Fortinet technologies in the security fabric and some of the automated kind of closed loop functions available there as well.
Yeah, that's got to be an issue for a SOC to close loop because you've got to, once a ticket opens, it still has to be closed out at the end of the day or whenever it gets resolved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
It's really interesting to see the transition in SOC. SOCs used to be this isolated ivory tower where nothing went in and nothing came out, and the answer was always no. And the transition or the inflection here is that these SOCs have to open up in the same way that networking has to open up and storage compute. But this transition is actually quite diverse, I think. And it's hard to imagine SOCs sharing their resources and integrating with the network like they have never done before.
Everything works together when everyone pulls together, right? I think, you know, we want them to hold us to account and we want them to advise us where, you know, things aren't done correctly or threats are seen, so we can action them.
Mm. Well, if you want to find out more, you can go to fortinet.com. You can also check out Node4 there at node4.co.uk. I thank you, Glenn, for joining us. And thanks to Fortinet for being a sponsor. You can find this and many more fine, free technical podcasts, along with our community blog. That's at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter at packetpushers. Find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and rate us on Apple Podcasts. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.